This is Audible.
Diabolical. Written by Milo Yiannopoulos. Narrated by Milo Yiannopoulos. Dedication. This book, like all my books, is for my husband, John, who has promised not to read chapter 2. Epigraph. Is the church not simply the continuation of God's deliberate plunge into human wretchedness? Is she not simply the continuation of Jesus' habit of sitting at the table with sinners, of his mingling with the misery of sin to the point where he actually seems to sink under its weight? Is there not revealed in the unholy holiness of the church, as opposed to man's expectation of purity, God's true holiness, which is love? Love that does not keep its distance in a sort of aristocratic, untouchable purity, but mixes with the dirt of the world, in order, thus, to overcome it. Can, therefore, the holiness of the church be anything else but the bearing with one another that comes, of course, from the fact that all of us are born up by Christ? Joseph Ratzinger, Introduction to Christianity.
Foreword. I am a Catholic, in part, because Milo Yiannopoulos encouraged me towards Rome. I know that will surprise a lot of readers, but it's true. From the moment I became aware of him causing a ruckus on American college campuses, I saw in Milo a depth and seriousness he only hints at in his mischievous and provocative lectures. Milo's talks got attention because his fearlessness and flamboyance were new to conservative politics. But examine the contents of his talks beneath the pyrotechnics, and you find a surprisingly orthodox set of commitments to beauty, to masculinity, to the life of the unborn, and to God. No wonder the left finds him so confounding and dangerous. None of his critics on the right acknowledge that at the heart of Milo's pranks and provocations has always been his fidelity to beauty, universal truth, justice, and his faith. But without those things, he could not have written this book. At its heart lies a profound sadness at the corruption of the Catholic Church, an institution which no longer prizes the heroic manly virtues that Milo encourages his student audiences to embrace, and which, he explains, the priesthood must rediscover. I started life as a Presbyterian, so I was used to seeing female clergy. But I was drawn later in life to a church with only male priests. I've been meditating on what it means to have a male priesthood that some would say excludes women, but I realize now this perspective is wrong. I've concluded that priests should be men and that they should be celibate, precisely because the church recognizes that men and women are equal, yet not the same. Among the many difficult, dangerous jobs men do, so women don't have to, is a lifelong calling to serve God at the altar. It's a daunting commitment, a vocation that takes discipline and courage, in which a man forswears becoming a husband and father to devote his life to prayer and to the church. It isn't supposed to be easy. As we have lost reverence for the family, the magnitude of this sacrifice appears smaller to us than it should. Joining the priesthood ought to take something away, not present the ambitious young college graduate with a path to an easy life in a grand home with minimal work hours and a boss who looks the other way at rampant sexual misbehavior. The great demands and great seriousness of the priesthood have been diluted, which might be why feminists want women let into the club. It looks like a prize to be won. Yes, it is baffling that an impish, occasionally foul-mouthed gay Brit, best known for trolling campus feminists into viral meltdowns, should reflexively understand all this and take the priesthood more seriously than a lot of people actually doing the job. But he too lives an unconventional life and has sacrificed his physical safety, among other things, to become a truth-teller. He knows what it means to live on the edge of society for the benefit of the rest of us. Milo was wrongly accused by the world's media in February 2017 of being soft on pedophilia because he'd spoken loosely about his own experiences with an abusive priest and told a few off-color jokes. I had never seen such a cruel attempt at a public execution on the basis of nothing. It shocked me. I realized what the world was prepared to do to smother unsayable truths and how dangerous the power of laughter is to despots. They did not break him. Milo is still fighting. His millions of fans still hang on his every word. This book is just as caustic and funny as his college talks and newspaper columns, and it reminds me of what I have always seen in Milo. A holy fool who travels the world in a tour bus with his face on it, dressed in outlandish clothes, needling his enemies with a cheeky smile and mirth in his heart. I have been attacked by feminist colleagues for mocking their preoccupation with straight white males. I survived because I followed the prescriptions set down in Milo's introductory memoir, Dangerous. Milo showed me, as he shows all of us with this new book, that rather than apologize and tiptoe around enemy combatants, we should confront them head-on in joyful warfare. Because we are right, and because Western civilization is worth saving, just as, wretched though she currently appears to us, the Bride of Christ deserves forgiveness and renewal. Rachel Fulton Brown, Chicago, Illinois, October 2018.
Chapter 1. Is the Pope Catholic? Pope Francis has said that shepherds should have the smell of their sheep. I'll buy that. But I wonder if the stench coming from the Vatican under his tenure isn't getting a bit much. This is the story of how child abuse in the Catholic Church, which peaked decades ago, threatens now to tear the Vatican apart because Pope Francis, or at least his accusers claim, has gone to extraordinary lengths to protect abusive priests who were personally loyal to him. It's about how decades-long guerrilla warfare between traditionalist and progressive Catholic bishops has blossomed into open civil war, prompted by explosive allegations of cover-ups by a lavender mafia of back-scratching gay bishops. Yes, there really is a gay mafia. It's in the Catholic Church, and yes, their outfits are fabulous. It's the story of how Western journalists have leapt to the defense of a pope who protected and rehired child molesters because they endorse the narrative of Francis as a reforming, left-leaning progressive. It's the story of a church whose hierarchy has lost its way and which desperately needs to earn back the trust of 1.2 billion of its following. It's about some of the changes the church and Christianity more generally have undergone over the past half century, whether any of them might have contributed to its present crisis of moral authority. And it's also the story of what happened to me in Kent, in England, in 1997, at the hands of a Catholic priest I knew as Father Michael. Whether or not the English-speaking press wants to cover it free of political preoccupations, the latest child abuse scandal to hit the Vatican has the potential to bring down the entire organization. I'm going to tell you how we should stop that from happening and why we should try. Because for all the ugly and horrifying sins of figures junior and senior in the Catholic Church, it is still a colossal force for good in the world. Indeed, Christianity through the Church is the foundation of just about everything that's worth preserving in Western civilization, to say nothing of its position as the sole international institution capable of resisting the rise of Islam. There are no angels in this story, although some players certainly come out with less damning indictments than others. But as documents, letters, first-hand accounts, and good old-fashioned whispering campaigns leak out of calfskin ecclesiastical briefcases, the outlook for Pope Francis continues to get worse. The fundamental facts of the story are these. Archbishop Carlo Maria Vigano, a former Vatican diplomat to the United States, has alleged that Pope Francis knew about the serial sexual harassment of seminarians by the now degraded former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, but that he rehabilitated McCarrick anyway, putting him back in circulation, giving speeches and appearing in public after Pope Benedict XVI had placed sanctions on McCarrick that limited his movements and his public activities. Vigano's accused Francis of moral turpitude and doctrinal heterodoxy, an extraordinary thing to level at the Pope, linking a dozen senior left-leaning church officials to child abuse in a long, detailed letter. He even went as far as to demand that the Pope steps down. The letter stated in public what many have long suspected about the Vatican, or known for sure if they had direct access to it, that a cabal of left-wing homosexuals wield huge power within the church, and they're bringing down the entire thing by covering up for each other's odious and exploitative wrongdoing. Theodore McCarrick's crimes have been described as some of the worst in church history. McCarrick has intense, dark-coloured eyes and a slightly hooked nose. But he's small, he looks like a friendly, mischievous older relative, and that's exactly how he styled himself to his victims. To young seminarians, he was Uncle Ted, an uncle who took his nephews to bed with him. The shortest man in the room and perpetually wearing a smirk, McCarrick preferred tall, slim, intelligent boys who did not smoke. The allegations against him go back decades, were well known as far afield as England, and they involve boys as young as 11. McCarrick was known as a voracious serial abuser, and his name was known as someone young seminarians should avoid as long ago as 1986. Six of McCarrick's victims came forward in 2018 to allege a variety of inappropriate and illegal sexual assaults. One account claims that in 1994, a young Irish man sent off to seminary had asked the director of priest personnel, "Has McCarrick stopped sleeping with the seminarians?" And he was told, "Oh yes, the papal nuncio and Bishop McHugh both spoke to him and told him to cut it out." 10 years later, three dioceses in New Jersey paid large cash settlements to keep stories about McCarrick quiet. During this time, McCarrick was one of America's highest-profile Catholic priests. But until this year, the entire Vatican hierarchy, all the way up to the Pope, claimed to know nothing about the allegations made against him, and that's what got people so furious. The lie isn't remotely believable, and that leaves people wondering if the Curia, including Francis himself, are just laughing at them. Why didn't American bishops do anything about their predatory peers for decades, leaving children and young men to be abused throughout the 1960s, 70s and 80s with no recourse? Vigano's letter is the first time a senior figure in the church has broken ranks to demand answers. The church's culture of resignation and complicity and the evident widespread moral failings simply can't be ignored any longer. That's what commentators are saying, and many of them have been party to gossip or were themselves abused during the period in question. For one thing, court settlements are starting to reach eye-watering sums, with four men awarded $27.5 million, just between the four of them, in September 2018 for abuse they suffered when they were between 8 and 12 years old. Needless to say, Vigano's account has landed in St. Peter's Square like a lorry full of IUDs. And I say it's left-leaning church leaders he's gone after because the letter is a who's who of Pope Francis's generals and intimates, many of the most influential left-wingers in the church. Now, this problem isn't exclusively confined to the left, but it does seem as though many of the bishops who've been most recently fingered have been from the reforming, or rather radical, political left. Now, those who are not accused of child abuse themselves are accused of helping to brush it under the carpet. And it does seem, although there are conservatives just as guilty, that the worst offenders, the people who did the worst things and the people who covered up the worst things, are precisely the same people, just coincidentally, working to dilute church teaching on sexual matters, in line with fashionable left-wing thinking. Is the conservative Archbishop Vigano politically motivated? Well, quite possibly. But that doesn't mean his allegations aren't true. And as best we can tell, not a single claim in Vigano's account has been disputed, either by journalists or by any of the people he names. Child abuse is the least appropriate political football imaginable, in which the only priority should be seeing to the needs of victims and making sure abusive priests are found and dealt with. But at least, thanks to Vigano, some of this stuff is finally coming to light. The Catholic Church, in case you don't know, has been reeling from the effects of a liberalizing movement that began in the 1960s with a doctrinal conference called the Second Vatican Council. Back then, Pope John the 23rd sought to open the windows by modernizing the church, but the results of Vatican II have been a disaster. An implosion of discipline and the corruption of the liturgy have created a church that revolves around sentimentality and self-love instead of God. The church has decayed from a place of instruction and tough love and a route to salvation to something that better resembles a sort of self-help club. Since Vatican II, most popes have been preoccupied with holding together the conservative and liberal factions that emerged in the wake of this disaster and which have regularly threatened to tear the church in two. Initially, Francis remained aloof after the bomb went off and Vigano's letter dropped, refusing to be drawn on the subject even when asked about it directly by journalists. He'd got a sort of practiced air of inscrutability, this Pope, which has served him well in the past, but it didn't work this time because his natural chutzpah got the best of him. He couldn't resist even though he ignored the inquiries from those journalists, taking a swipe at his accusers in a public forum barely a week later. This is one of France's favourite techniques. He'll refuse to comment on the record to journalists, and then he'll weave in subtle references and snarky asides to his critics in homilies, in religious sermons. And indeed, on September the 3rd, he told the crowd that silence makes us better imitators of Christ, as if to say, I know all this stuff makes us look bad, but would you all please just shut up? The following week, sensing danger, he went on the offensive in another public sermon, and he said, quote, in these times it seems like the great accuser has been unchained and is attacking bishops. True, we are all sinners, we bishops. He tries to uncover the sins so they are visible in order to scandalize the people. The great accuser, as he himself says to God in the first chapter of the book of Job, roams the earth looking for someone to accuse, end quote. He doubled down 2 days later. And he said, the only legitimate accusations that we Christians have is to accuse ourselves. He contrasted the Lord's invitation to be merciful with the great accuser Satan, who urges us to accuse others, to destroy them. Turns out sunlight isn't the best disinfectant after all. Despite the fact that Francis himself had repeatedly called for absolute transparency in the church's dealings, when given the chance to prove himself and when the allegations hit too close to home, suddenly this pope is giving speeches about the devil and naming bishops as the true injured party in the child abuse scandal. I mean, you can almost hear the sound of jaws hitting the floor in victim support groups. Is the pope Catholic? And it's not a joke. Some of us have been wondering. Since Francis described bishops accused of raping children or covering up the rape of children as like Jesus on Good Friday, in the fourth such statement that he made in 2 weeks since the Vergano letter dropped, it's just left us all agog. Francis said in his morning homily at the chapel at Santa Marta on that day that Jesus, in response to the cries of crucify him, had, quote, remained silent because he had compassion for those people deceived by the powerful, end quote. Francis seems to be implying that Vergano journalists and victims are the powerful people deceiving the following, deceiving the flock, deceiving other Catholics about the poor, innocent bishops. This stuff is difficult to believe. It's tough to imagine that a pope would have said this stuff in public, but this is how Francis operates. And he added on that day, in the same way the pastor in difficult times, in times when the devil is unleashed, where the pastor is accused by the great accuser through so many people, so many powerful ones, suffers, offers his life, and prays. In his eagerness to feed conspiracies about a powerful right-wing movement out to destroy him, the Pope has apparently forgotten the necessity and purpose of that most Catholic thing, confession. If these bishops have nothing to confess, they have nothing to say, but clearly they have plenty to own up to, in which case keeping silent is a sin. A senior correspondent for a Catholic magazine told me in early September 2018 that Rome is a wreck. A disaster. No one knows what to do. Everyone is panicking, and those who are speaking are saying very stupid things. He didn't say he meant Francis, but that was heavily implied. The Vatican under Francis has been ignoring the child abuse scandal at best and actively working to suppress it at worst. The Vatican under Francis has been ignoring the child abuse scandal at best and actively working to suppress it at worst. Its efforts have been aided by an international press that gleefully reports on Francis's veiled criticisms of Donald Trump and unsubtle references to the inefficacy of walls. Journalists regard Francis as a heroic left-winger who says all the right things about Muslims and immigrants. Immediately after the Vergano letter went public, an obviously shaken Vatican released a statement that it would respond to the allegations that Pope Francis had covered up sexual abuse by McCarrick, but that wasn't actually the allegation that Vergano had made. Of course, both of those things may be true, but this just goes to show how much of a panic the Vatican is in. At the same time, allies of Francis have begun briefing journalists that Vergano is a right-winger who was driven by a grudge because he was once punished for arranging a meeting between Pope Francis and Kim Davis, the county clerk in Kentucky, who made international headlines when she defied a federal court order to issue same-sex marriage licenses in August 2015. Then, without denying the main charge in Vergano's letter that Francis had known about McCarrick's predatory behavior and Benedict's punitive sanctions, but rehabilitated McCarrick anyway, allies of the Pope have begun wondering aloud how severe Benedict's sanctions had really been, trying to sort of spread the muck around. And they may have a point about that. It's possible Benedict was a little naive about how effective his punishment would be at keeping McCarrick, a lifelong fame addict, out of the public eye. Donald Wool, the Archbishop of Washington, as I write, who assumed McCarrick's position after the latter retired in 2006, initially claimed that he knew nothing about either the crimes or the punishment of his predecessor. This is very hard to believe. His first comment about the McCarrick allegations is said to have been, "Oh, I don't think this is a massive, massive crisis." You can see him on YouTube saying it. Now, perhaps Wall is the sort of guy so unruffled by drama that he wouldn't miss a coffee date in a nuclear apocalypse, but it's not very likely. Wall announced in September that he would be resigning anyway because, yep, you guessed it, he's also been accused of mismanaging other past claims of clerical abuse. A grand jury report claims that 1,000 children were abused by more than 300 priests over 70 years in Pennsylvania, and that local bishops covered it up. Donald Wall, who was Archbishop of Pittsburgh at the time, is named in the report as someone who vouched for an abusive priest. Now, at the same time all this has been going on, pontifical acolytes have started offering thinly disguised warnings to conservative critics, which seem to boil down to, leave this one alone, because there's plenty of skeletons to go around, know what I mean? But none of this has stopped the bleeding, none of the usual Team Francis tactics, and there's now a consensus that Francis has messed up, and he must answer the questions posed by Vergano. Did he know about the allegations swirling around McCarrick and rehabilitate him anyway? Did he talk to Wall about it? If so, is he in the habit of looking the other way when one of his intimates is found to have done something awful? And does he think this all serves a higher moral purpose in some way, or is he merely seeking to preserve his own power and consolidate the power of his friends? Francis's defenders have been quick to point out that the moment a credible report of abuse reached the Vatican, Theodore McCarrick was publicly degraded by Francis, and that's an arguable claim. Degradation is a process, by the way, through which a priest is stripped of his title and his office, and Theodore McCarrick has the distinction of being the world's only ex-cardinal. Catholics should be reassured that just as there is a saint for everything, my personal favourite being St. Gabriel Porcenti, the official patron saint of gun owners, so in turn does the liturgy hold all answers. Not a happy day for Francis, I'll bet, having to stand in front of McCarrick and softly intone the Latin that stripped him of his bishopric. The usual Francis playbook of refusing to comment, sticking it to opponents in his sermons, and then distracting the press with a left-wing stunt isn't working this time. Perhaps Francis was never really the PR mastermind his supporters think. Maybe he's merely been coasting on left-wing privilege, insulated from tough questions by his Trump hatred and the occasional broadside against capitalism and nationalism. Francis's response to allegations that Bishop Juan Barros Madrid, one of his oldest pals, had covered up child abuse had been to hiss, "The day someone brings me proof against Bishop Barros, then I'll talk, but there is not one single piece of evidence. It's all slander. Is that clear?" All Francis appeared to care about was reflexively defending an ally. When later a 2,300-page report alleged that the church officials in Chile had covered up child abuses for decades, every active and retired bishop in Chile offered to resign. This is an unprecedented event in the history of the church, and Francis was eventually forced to admit he made grave errors handling the Chilean scandal, and 158 people are now under investigation. Pope Francis has been mired in sex scandals since the day he picked up a mitre. 20 deaf-mute children were abused at the Provolo Institute School for Deaf in Mendoza, Argentina, according to accusers who came forward in 2016. 5 men have been arrested so far, including priests Nicola Corradi and Horacio Corbajo. Pope Francis was the Bishop of Buenos Aires at the time of the alleged assaults, and in 2017, an Argentine woman who came forward to detail alleged abuse at the hands of a cleric in the Archdiocese of Buenos Aires while Francis was serving as Archbishop accused the Pope of putting celebrity photo ops before sex crime victims. She says he was more concerned with visits from movie stars like Leonardo DiCaprio, and he didn't acknowledge her complaints with so much as a letter of response. "I don't expect anything from him," she now says, and she told a French TV station, "I don't believe in him. I suffered, and now I'm very disappointed." She's still waiting for a reply to her letters. None of this stuff surprises people who remember Francis as Archbishop Jorge Bergoglio. In a 2010 book on Heaven and Earth, Francis claimed that sexual abuse by members of the priesthood never occurred in his diocese, writing, and his choice of words is quite telling, It never happened to me. Never happened to me. But at exactly the same time as writing that sexual abuse by members of the priesthood had never occurred in his diocese, Francis had commissioned a gigantic study designed to pour cold water on accusations against the church. The report speculated that false accusers were projecting their sexual fantasies onto innocent clergymen. Pretty audacious stuff, this, saying you knew nothing about sexual abuse in your diocese while commissioning a report to undermine confidence in accusers. And then, sometime later, comparing whistleblowers to Satan by invoking the great accuser. But as the British Spectator magazine has noted, the duplicitous pontiff depicted by Vigano is instantly recognisable as the cynical backstabbing Bergoglio in Henry Sire's book The Dictator Pope, which, although it's profoundly hostile to its subject, is based on first-hand testimony from Argentina and Rome. One of the only responses from Francis to the September 2018 crisis engulfing his pontificate has been to invite Bono to the Vatican, so the U2 singer could later tell the press how aghast the Pope is at the allegations against him. Again, that word, aghast, is interesting, suggesting outrage and shock, righteous indignation, rather than horror and contrition. Bono had previously dedicated a song to, can you guess, his old friend Theodore McCarrick. Aghast is an interesting choice of words until you see Francis's actions as those of a bog-standard social justice warrior, who always doubles down on mistakes in times of crisis and who audaciously presents his victims as the true aggressors. Francis's social justice credentials don't end there. Consider a passage in Sire's book in which one of Francis's cronies conflates words with violence in a manner that would make a campus feminist proud, whilst also suggesting that Francis should be beyond all criticism. Archbishop Reino Frisella, whom Francis allows to serve as president of the Council for the New Evangelization, suggests that anyone who badmouths the Pope should be punished as though they had physically assaulted him because, quote, words too are rocks and stones, end quote. The punishment for assaulting a Pope is excommunication. This is a maneuver straight out of the Black Lives Matter Antifa playbook. It's often fed to impressionable students by Marxist professors, and its sophistry works in both directions. On the one hand, it means someone who merely says something that you don't like deserves to be treated as a violent criminal. Conversely, when in response you smash a bike lock across someone's skull, all you've done is exercise your right to free speech. This cancer has reached the pages of the New York Times, which works hard to make violent left-wing activism look respectable and justified. And in this case, Archbishop Reino Frisella is saying that criticism of the Pope is the same as throwing rocks and stones at him. Once again, the punishment for doing so to a Pope is excommunication. The clear implication of Frisella's claim is that people who criticize the Pope should be excommunicated from the Church. Child abuse cover-ups in the Catholic Church have proceeded in service of a culture that operates on reputation and on shame. And in that, it's just like the modern social media-driven online mob culture. It produces oddly similar results. The compromised, the amoral, and the power-hungry have threatened, harassed, and stymied the careers of potential whistleblowers, and the worst offenders have been protected at all costs. Now, it's true that Popes John Paul II and Benedict XVI were probably negligent in dealing with child abuse claims, but they can scarcely be accused of the sort of outright complicity Francis is now said to have displayed in reinstating a pedophile priest, and for the sleaziest and most disreputable reason imaginable. He reinstated Theodore McCarrick because McCarrick was left-leaning, supported Francis politically, and did his bidding when called upon. Theodore McCarrick became one of the Pope's most trusted advisers during a period in which everyone now believes the Pope knew what he'd been doing. And that's why Francis must be clear about what he knew of the allegations against him at that time. McCarrick had shamelessly defied whatever sanctions Benedict XVI had placed on him, continuing to appear in public and to give speeches. Benedict's sanctions were not only weak, it seems, but not especially well enforced. After his return to the inner circle, McCarrick bragged that Francis had put him back in business, inviting friendly journalists to report sympathetically on his churchgoer-funded globetrotting. David Gibson of the Religion News Service duly obliged in June 2014 with 1,300 cloying words that described the sex abuser as telegenic, with a welcoming face and a twinkle in his eye. He described McCarrick as having a sense of humour as keen as the Pope's, I'll say. The piece praised his classic McCarrick style, and in case you still weren't sure what to think of him, Gibson wrote that McCarrick was a favourite target of conservatives. Well, that settles that. Must be a good hombre. Gibson's story was reprinted in the National Catholic Reporter under the vomit-inducing headline, "Globe-trotting Cardinal Theodore McCarrick is almost 84 and working harder than ever." It also appeared in the Washington Post. If Vergano's claims are true, this report and the event it describes occurred a year after Vergano told Pope Francis that McCarrick had corrupted generations of priests and seminarians. In other words, Francis knew about the allegations, but sent his old friend McCarrick out into the world anyway to lecture young people about climate change at the laity's expense. Now, this is just a wild guess, but I'm thinking the old man doesn't fly coach. How much money was spent providing McCarrick with a globe-trotting retirement plan and regular access to young people, while Francis pretended not to know about the allegations? In Gibson's report, McCarrick explains why he'd been out of circulation recently. Pope Benedict, he says, quote, was anxious to bring the church back to where he thought it should be, and I guess I wasn't one of those who he thought would help him on that, end quote. If by bring the church back to where he thought it be, McCarrick meant make it no longer a place I can diddle kids and then get rewarded with round-the-world plane tickets, then yeah, I guess this is a fair gloss. The details of the McCarrick story get more mind-bending and incredible the more you read. In 2002, US bishops issued new guidelines for priests that are said to have dramatically reduced the incidence of sexual assaults. But this new Dallas charter exempted bishops, and therefore cardinals, from its rules. The author of these new guidelines, that would be one Theodore McCarrick, who was exempted from the guidelines himself. Well, they do say poachers make the best gamekeepers. Francis's allies, who are, like him, radical left-leaning reformers, have played roles in protecting child abusers, pretending not to see what's going on. Or they have themselves abused children. A close friend of the Pope's, Cardinal Maradiaga, is accused of looking the other way when sexual harassment was going on at a seminary in Honduras. And Cardinal Godfrey Daniels was infamously caught on tape in 2010, urging an abuse victim to stay silent, even though that victim was making specific, substantiated allegations about his own uncle, the Bishop of Bruges. That bishop later admitted the assault, saying about a second nephew he abused, quote, I had the strong impression that my nephew didn't mind at all. On the contrary, it was not brutal sex. I never used bodily, physical violence. He was convicted of sexually abusing the first boy since the age of 5. But he maintained, quote, I don't have the impression at all that I am a pedophile, end quote. That former bishop from Bruges underwent therapy, but by 2017 he'd rediscovered his mojo, and he now has a new containment strategy. He sues anyone who comes forward to say he abused them. 3 years after begging abuse victims to stay silent, his protector, Daniels, campaigned for Bergoglio's election to the papacy and stood with him on the loggia when the newly elected Pope Francis was presented to the world. Some of the statements made by close friends of Pope Francis are so heartless it's hard to believe they're real. Victor Manuel Fernandez, Archbishop of La Plata in Argentina and a close friend of the Pope's, has insisted that the acknowledgement of abuse claims is pointless and only feeds the megalomania, his word, of attention-seeking accusers, which is why Francis has said nothing about the scandal so far. He said, the Pope always said it is not advisable to defend himself from people who seek the limelight because it would give them what they seek and feed their megalomania. That's what Fernandez told an interviewer. I guess that criterion applies in this case, he added. Sadly, this kind of attitude is the norm, not the exception, in Team Francis. Fernandez has also accused Vergano of wanting attention and of acting like a teenager in bringing the cover-up to light. Church insiders say John Paul II was better than Francis on child abuse, but it is Benedict who escapes with the least blood on his hands. But Benedict is by no means blameless, even if his lack of action on abusers came more from a sort of paralysis and perhaps poor leadership skills than conscious mendacity and wickedness, as appears to be the case with his successor. So this is probably not a moment for acolytes of the retired Papa Benedetto to crow, at least not until the allegations against Benedict himself are cleared up. For instance, the suggestion that while an archbishop in the 1980s, he failed to heed warnings about a priest, Reverend Peter Hullerman, who forced an 11-year-old boy to perform oral sex on him at a camp retreat in 1979 and who abused several other children over the course of 2 decades. In July 1986, Hullerman was convicted of sexually abusing more minors and of distributing pornography, but he was still working with children as late as 2010. Parishioners in Bad Tölz, where he was working between 2008 and 2010, described him as, this is chilling, especially popular with children and teenagers. It's certainly true that the worst actors in all of this are gay. And they're also hardline leftist reformers, as are the majority of those accused of looking the other way while abuse was happening. But away from the politics, this is a catastrophe that puts the church at risk of total collapse. There's a crisis of confidence brewing in the church now, the likes of which it has not weathered since the Reformation. And there's no getting away from it this time by victim blaming, ducking questions from reporters, or throwing shade at your political opponents in homilies. A case is forming against Pope Francis that paints him as the most complicit bishop of Rome in decades, and perhaps ever, when it comes to covering up the abuses of children and of protecting others who stood by while minors were assaulted. Pope Francis has even gone as far as to criticize victims groups, accusing them of slander, before finally being shamed into staging a formal investigation into the aforementioned Bishop Madrid. As the drama has unfurled, even mild-mannered commentators, not normally known for their prurience, now ask questions like, could the colleges in Rome, established for the education of especially promising seminarians from all over the world, in effect be gay bordellos? Does promotion in the hierarchy come at a price for young priests? Did the Vatican invest $27 million into a building that housed 18 senior priests, but was also the home of Europa Multiclub, Europe's largest gay bathhouse? Can it really be true, as Vanity Fair said it found in 2013, that there's a Monsignor nicknamed Jessica who passes his business card out to 25-year-old novices and a notorious gay prostitute in Rome who poses in black leather on private balconies and in the innermost corridors of the Vatican? The answer to all those questions, by the way, is yes. If Pope Francis knew everything Vigano alleges he did and protected McCarrick right down to the wire anyway, it's conceivable that the modern papacy as an institution could collapse. The papacy has not adapted to modernity by developing something like Britain's parliamentary democracy. The Pope has absolute authority over the church in the matter of a monarch from centuries past, and individual bishops, too, wield a huge amount of power over their diocese because their subordinates have to swear a vow of obedience and fealty to their own bishop. The Vatican may be the sole remaining world autocracy, and it's certainly the most enduring and least transparent. But while in good times this is an efficient form of government, today it presents a problem. Ordinary Catholics have lost patience with the church's ministers, and they're now openly asking what, if anything, can be done if the guy in charge refuses to discipline wayward deputies. We will return to that subject later. Since his election, Francis has done everything possible to sexually liberalize the church, subverting its long-standing teachings on human sexuality, and that's why the Lavender Mafia was so delighted to see him sworn in, because they want that too. But he's also gone out of his way to excuse and cover up for friends who are guilty of appalling abuses of power, and with boys as young as 11. The cardinals named by Vigano have done nothing to clear their names, because they likely have no defense. But it's also because they know that Francis, the pervert's pope, will shelter them to the end. Chapter 3. Enemy of the People. Instances of child abuse in the Catholic Church have been dropping precipitously for decades, at least in the United States. And I won't be so rash as to claim that it doesn't happen anymore, but statistically speaking, the problem of child sex abuse in the church appears to be correcting itself, or at least rapidly falling into line with other similar organizations, from a peak between 1965 and 1980. So one question you might be asking is, why are we still hearing about this? More specifically, why are we only hearing about it now? The main reason abuse claims and reporting about abuse claims trails the offences themselves by decades is that victims often take decades to speak out about their experiences. Quite often they pipe up in their mid-30s, and that was certainly the case for me. Although I can't speak for other victims, I have a pretty good idea why that might be, why it is that people don't tell their stories until much later in life. I don't think it's because anyone who ever got fiddled with has been so utterly traumatized by it he's been unable to function as a human being ever since. Now, doubtless for some victims that's the case, and of course my heart goes out to them, but I think people like that are in the minority. What I think's really going on is that by 30 you have enough else going on in your life. So disclosing the embarrassing fact that a priest years ago did something inappropriate to you isn't going to define you. It's not going to take over your entire existence. By the age of 35, you hopefully have a family of your own through whom your identity is forged and who can provide emotional support. The unfortunate minority who are permanently crippled by their child abuse experiences have understandably, I suppose, permitted it to define them so much that their entire being has become a sort of expression of the trauma. Now, I've known rape victims of both kinds, and I think the same thing is going on with them. Another explanation for the delay we've experienced in hearing about abuse that peaked in the 60s, 70s, and 80s is the reliably useless finger-in-the-air approach from the church hierarchy, which, under Francis, has ascended to the status of a systematic cover-up. At the very highest levels, at the expense of victims past and present, in service to the continued power of a small group of cardinals and bishops, including the Pope himself. But it's not just that there are powerful homosexuals covering for each other. The structure and operations of the Vatican are riddled with bureaucracy and corruption that prevent vital reform. Just like any other city in which power and money are concentrated, the Vatican is rife with plots, backstabbing, and rivalry. But the usual skullduggery and jostling for position that go on in, say, Washington DC are elevated to theatrical levels of intrigue in the Vatican because the stakes are so high. After all, he who controls the Vatican controls the Catholic Church and thus commands spiritual authority of 1.2 billion people. And there's an awful lot of money sloshing around too, in relatively few hands. Most people familiar with the workings of the Vatican describe it as comically ineffective and dysfunctional, the product of a thousand little schemes that make critical documents disappear at just the right moment and which make accountability practically impossible. Add to that the Vatican's way of dealing with sensitive matters, which often leaves no paper trail, and you have a recipe for chaos, easily exploitable by well-connected sociopaths who can command the loyalty of the Curia, whether through ideological fealty or straight intimidation. Kurt Martins, a professor of canon law at the Catholic University of America, has explained it like this. Rome often works with oral reports, he says, and that makes it harder. Quote, it's the Italian way of dealing with these things, especially when they involve a cardinal or a bishop. End quote. This may be one reason Vigano's allegations prove difficult to substantiate or to disprove. There simply aren't records of bishops who've been scolded. Corruption and misappropriation of funds are standard operating procedure in Rome. In September 2018, the Vatican confirmed that the Sistine Chapel Choir's manager and director were being investigated for money laundering, fraud, and embezzlement. Profits from concerts are said to have been paid directly into an account held by manager Michelangelo Nardella and director Monsignor Massimo Palombola and used for personal expenses. Palombola is also under investigation for abusive conduct during choir rehearsals. By Vatican standards, though, that's JV-level stuff. And to give you an example of what I mean, consider the Vatican Bank. The Vatican Bank is one of the most disreputable and ineptly managed financial institutions in the world. For decades, it has operated as a tax haven for wealthy Italians and a money launderer's paradise. It is essentially an offshore bank in the middle of Rome, subject to its own laws. And it was, therefore, at least for a while, incredibly resistant to demands for information from the Italian authorities, who are not themselves always the perfect model of good governance. International media scrutiny of the bank is said to be one of the reasons Benedict XVI resigned, admitting privately to friends that he was unable to tackle the entrenched special interests in Rome. After taking some time to admire Pope Francis for wearing a plastic watch and dining in the Vatican canteen, The Guardian's Paul Vallely gave a decent account recently of how Cardinal George Pell, appointed by Francis, began a review of the bank's operations. Pell had successfully overhauled the church's finances in Sydney and Melbourne. The Australian son of a former heavyweight boxer, Pell is a political and doctrinal conservative who speaks aggressively and does not believe in man-made climate change. He's a cult hero among conservative Catholics, so you can just imagine what the Lavender Mafia think of him. Valerie notes grudgingly that for all his conservatism, Pell had for years been a vocal critic of the Roman Catholic bureaucracy and its corruption. Pell moved quickly after he was appointed, and he made a lot of enemies. He's a straight dealer to the point of unbearable bluntness, especially in the delicately perfumed and gold-embroidered world of the Holy See. So Pell probably didn't anticipate getting tripped up by dirty tactics. In this case, stories leaked to the press about, yep, clerical abuse. The press reports were coincidentally timed, arriving just as Pell's reforms of the bank were beginning to take hold. It was alleged in the media that Pell was soft on child abuse, thanks to offhand comments he'd made years before in his typically ribald and direct Australian fashion. It was suggested that he may even himself have some questions to answer about covering up abuse. Then the allegations widened as he began to demand more of bank officials and uncover more bureaucracy and more corruption. Stories appeared that directly accused him of historic sex abuse, at which point he had to stop reforming the bank, put his work on hold, and return to Australia to try to clear his name. That's what he did, and now, of course, Vatican bank reforms are stalling, just as those intriguers intended. And this is how efforts to clean up the Roman Catholic Church usually end. Another factor to consider in the delay between these abuses and us hearing about them now is how incompetently the media cover religion. For a subject as critical not just to world affairs, but to Western civilization itself, religion is almost unimaginably poorly served by establishment reporters. Very few British or American newspapers have dedicated religion correspondents any longer, and where religion is covered nationally in the United States, it's almost always subservient to the political agenda of the masthead, with reporting from people who know hilariously little about their subject. With a few exceptions, publications aimed at millennials are astonishingly bad at reporting on religious subjects, and that might be because there are literally no Christians on staff. There are some exceptions. Although she makes no effort to hide her leftism, Vox's Tara Isabella Burton at least makes an effort to understand the views of her subjects and is properly qualified. She seems to know her beat. But her stablemates at Vox merrily hold forth on religion without the slightest grasp of basic facts. We're now in the remarkable position that national newspapers in America publish lead stories about religion that contain glaring howlers of the type that any church-going Catholic could correct, because there's no one left in the building with any domain expertise, and you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone working for a major TV or news channel who knows, for instance, what a papal nuncio is. My favourite example of this in action was the New York Times reporter who asked Christian writer and editor Father Richard John Neuhaus of First Things what he made of the fact that the newly elected Pope was, quote, also, end quote, going to be named the Bishop of Rome. If it's not obvious to you why that's funny, the Pope is, by definition, the Bishop of Rome. That's his job. Christianity in general, and Catholicism in particular, is an impossibly complex subject for a general reporter to master in an afternoon. But because reporters, editors, and proprietors are mostly Democrat and mostly secularist, religion has been one of the first areas to go when newsroom cuts have been made over the past decade. Unless it's pandering to Islam to annoy Republicans, they just don't want to know about it. So we're left with specialist magazine writers, all of whom have their own particular biases and objectives. Perhaps the only reason this latest child abuse conflagration has captured the attention of English-speaking journalists is that they've identified a way to bash conservatives in the story by pointing out that Vigano's political leanings suggest he may be biased, and because any kind of sexual abuse story is grounds for an otiose pivot back to the Me Too movement and another 400 words about the evils of patriarchy. In matters of theology and the complex arena of church politics, journalists do what they do in any situation where the facts would be too exhausting or time-consuming to uncover, which is they go with the guy the conservatives hate. In this case, that means siding with McCarrick and Francis. As Ben Shapiro correctly points out, The media have rushed to Francis' defense because Francis is widely perceived to share leftist sensibilities regarding issues like climate change, illegal immigration, and homosexuality. The media believe that the abuse of children is of lower priority than climate change and illegal immigration. Furthermore, they fear that focus will be placed on a homosexual subculture within the church, some of whose participants have been linked with molestation, end quote. Tough stuff, but it's perfectly accurate. It's possible that journalists genuinely don't know what all the fuss is about. After all, so many of their own idols are pederasts. As the great firebrand Anthony Eastlin, writing for Crisis magazine, reminds us, San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official in the US, groomed and seduced young boys. But he was turned by the left into a civil rights hero. Harry Hay, Allen Ginsberg, and William S. Burroughs are all taught in literature courses. All three were blatant and proud pederasts. Lolita is considered great literature. The old boys of the left covered endlessly for Sir John Gielgud. R. Kelly's exile seemed to last minutes. Roman Polanski was given the red carpet treatment on his way back into the tent by Meryl Streep, and that's before we even get to the decades of La 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 I'm Not Listening it took to keep Kevin Spacey's cocaine-fueled indiscretions with young men out of the press, or to hush up Guardians of the Galaxy director James Gunn's obsession with sexualized images of children and his creepy personal blog on which he bragged about beating up his midget girlfriend. But if the media doesn't really care about sex with minors, they gleefully assaulted this author when he dared to make a few jokes about his own experiences and speak frankly about a few facts of gay life. Couldn't be, could it? That in fact, journalists care nothing at all for the victims of child sex abuse and instead use this emotive subject merely to destroy their political opponents. Couldn't be, could it, that pederasty is only bad when conservatives do it? And that it's so bad that merely joking about something that happened to you is enough to get you machine-gunned. But how else to explain the behaviour of the mainstream press this year? Everything journalists have done in reporting this crisis has been to protect the reputation of a pope perceived as a leftist and to save the feelings of the homosexual lobby, which hates it when gay people are talked about honestly in public as the promiscuous, low-income, drug-taking, reckless and often very unhappy people we statistically are. The cover-up in the Vatican is a gay crime, performed by gay men in service of other gay men, concerning assaults overwhelmingly performed by men on young boys, and a debased culture of gay orgies in what ought to be an educational establishment. In the Catholic world, gay scandals have a habit of multiplying, and that's not just because young male seminarians tessellate. It's not just a gay crime, it's also predominantly a left-wing gay crime, with the perpetrators more likely than not to be hippy-dippy, loosey-goosey innovators with the liturgy, heterodox on family matters, and very bad managers of diocesan resources, especially the schools, in the words of one journalist. In the long run, no amount of soft-peddling from the New York Times is going to obscure the fact that the corrupt, socialist, homosexual mafia in charge of the Holy See is a disease, which, if it's left untreated, is going to destroy the Catholic Church. Maybe that's the New York Times' plan, but the rest of us are not going to stand by and watch it happen. You can imagine the panic, can't you, at the New York Times when a new scandal erupts and it looks like all the bad guys are left-wing gays. You know, reporters go and Google them and all that comes up is speech after speech after speech about climate change and how best to embrace Islamic migrants. Well, they quickly take to their typewriters and whatever can be published to distract attention from the perpetrators is hastily cobbled together for the morning edition. Take this Times headline from August 2018, which appeared in print as "Francis takes high road as conservatives pounce, taking criticisms public." Online, the Times headlined the story, "Vatican power struggle bursts into open as conservatives pounce." And that phrase, conservatives pounce, has become something of a joke since. But here's how that story began. "Since the start of his papacy," says the New York Times, "Francis has infuriated Catholic traditionalists as he tries to nurture a more welcoming church and shift it away from culture war issues, whether abortion or homosexuality. Who am I to judge?" the Pope famously said when asked about gay priests. Just how angry his political and doctrinal enemies are became clear this weekend when a caustic letter published by the Vatican's former top diplomat in the United States blamed a homosexual current in the Vatican hierarchy for sexual abuse. In case that's too subtle for readers, embedded in the page before the main body of the story was a video of Francis with that "who am I to judge" malarkey about queers. So Times readers are left in no doubt who the bad guys are. Elsewhere, the same day, Reuters published a story with the headline, "Defenders rally around Pope, fear conservatives escalating war." Not much mention of the allegations against Pope Francis that he covered up the rape of children. The media's protection of Francis worked for a while, most notably in the early myth-building period of his papacy. As recently as November 2017, the Washington Post was still running headlines like "How Pope Francis Can Cleanse the Far-Right Rot from the Catholic Church." That one aged well. Catholic news services have expressed surprise on the rare occasion a mainstream outlet has covered alleged wrongdoing by Francis without smothering the reporting in defensive language or vague gesturing toward a conservative conspiracy. Pope Francis enjoyed remarkably high approval ratings among Americans for some time, but down from a peak of two-thirds in early 2017, only 48% of Americans have a favorable view of Pope Francis, as of this writing, because no amount of spin can obscure the facts. Among Catholics, the number is 63%, down from 83%. Among Republicans, Francis's approval sits at just 36% in one CNN poll. A second Gallup poll showed a similarly low approval rate among the general American population of just 53%. This is an enormously sharp downturn for a pope we were constantly being told was the most popular ever. The pope's approval rating is expected to drop even further, with women abandoning their previous fondness for Francis at the most rapid rate out of all demographic groups, which is perhaps the maternal instinct finally kicking in. First Things editor Rusty Reno suggests that the lingering cover-up culture in America might have been made possible because America's bishops began the 19th century unusually powerful and autonomous. Their authority wasn't limited by hundreds of years' worth of Catholic institutions, such as libraries, faculties, and cathedral chapters, and they were not subject to European canon law. American bishops have acted more independently of Rome than their European counterparts, and some journalists conclude that, combined with the bishop-centric church structure that obtained after Vatican II, abuses in America have gone unpunished thanks to cowardice and poor oversight from Rome. But it appears that the Vatican knew what was happening all along and simply did nothing about it, some of the time feigning ignorance, and that's a trend that's reached its apotheosis under Pope Francis. One last note about the delay. Thomas Sowell has observed that any given social problem typically becomes a focus of attention and government action only well after the problem is significantly improving, usually with the effect of retarding progress. Certainly this has been the case in the campus rape crisis of the last half decade, an outpouring of confected rage about perhaps the safest public spaces for women anywhere in the world, at a time when rape rates are in freefall. The church and the media follow this rule now when it comes to clerical sexual abuse, reluctantly opening investigations when the worst offences are already half a century old, and the statute of limitations has long since passed. This virtually guarantees that victims will see no justice and no compensation for their ordeals. And if all that hasn't depressed you enough about the moral ruins of the Catholic Church, consider another reason that Francis ferociously protected Theodore McCarrick, and how the most morally indefensible actions by the Vatican come to be made, and why it takes decades to bring some of these men to justice long after the victims can have their proper day in court. And that is money. McCarrick, you see, was one of the church's most effective fundraisers, establishing a papal foundation in 1988 whose assets have grown today to more than $206 million. That foundation built $70,000 schools in Bangladesh, $90,000 libraries in Nicaragua, and $100,000 orthopedic units in Ghana, so you can't say it's doing no good work. But each of those projects comes with a nice overseas junket, or at least it used to, for Theodore McCarrick. Everything was going swimmingly at that foundation until the summer of 2017, when Pope Francis personally requested an immediate grant from the foundation of $25 million. That's 100 times higher than the usual grant size, and it was for a church-owned building in Rome that is notoriously corrupt. Rod Dreyer, writing for the American Conservative, reported that the hospital has been accused of money laundering and has liabilities of more than $1 billion. This is not normal, except perhaps in Italy. The Papal Foundation, which is maintained by wealthy Americans, does not invest in this kind of project, and it had been given no opportunity to perform due diligence on the hospital. But the bishops and cardinals on its board, led by none other than Cardinal Wall from Washington, forced through a wire transfer for half of the $25 million Francis was demanding just a few days after the request came in. What was the money for? Where did it go and to whom? We will probably never find out. When Francis was informed that the other half of that grant would not be forthcoming, he responded with spectacular pettiness. He cancelled the Foundation's annual audience with him at the Vatican. And the plot thickens still more, and this is why I'm telling you of all this, when you discover that one board member, Tim Bush, is friends with the author of the letter that began this whole scandal in the first place, Archbishop Vigano. Could this be a case of telling the truth about sex as payback for arrogant senior clerics pushing around the laity and picking their pockets? That's a question Rod Dreyer has asked. For all its rapacious acquisition of wealth, the money the Vatican does manage to collect from naive donors is spent so haphazardly and accounted for so incompetently, or just as likely dishonestly, that it makes you wonder why they bother in the first place. But to understand, as a lay Catholic, just how badly the Church spends your money, you first have to understand how thoroughly the organization was co-opted, decades ago, by communist activists. Yes, you heard that right. Despite popular myth, the Church has never been a friend to European fascism. John Cornwell's malicious and error-strewn 1999 bestseller Hitler's Pope, which was of course warmly received by the media with a title like that, was a libel on the legacy of Pius XII, and it helped to solidify the myth of the Catholic Church as a sinister, Nazi-sympathizing right-wing club, in